Coming up on Path to Zero.
We need to keep our options open. There are many, many pathways to decarbonization, not just a full electric route.
Welcome to Path to Zero, the podcast about clean energy and the journey toward a low-carbon future. Your host is Tucker Perkins, engineer, entrepreneur, business leader, speaker, and clean energy industry veteran, who now serves as president and CEO of the Propane Education and Research Council. Now, here's Tucker.
Hello, Path to Zero listeners. It's great to have you along for the journey once again. How about a quick thought exercise? I want you to think about battery electric vehicles for just a moment. You'll hear me refer to them as EVs. What ideas pop into your head when you hear that acronym? Maybe you're thinking about descriptions like clean or Tesla or climate friendly. Those are fairly common thoughts, but my guest today has a set of uncommon facts to tell us about EVs. Dr. Graham Conway is a principal engineer in the automotive division of Southwest Research Institute in San Antonio, where he specializes in evaluating automotive technologies for both government and the private sector. He's been comparing the environmental impact of gas-powered, electric, and hybrid vehicles. His surprising findings are detailed in his TED Talk, The Contradictions of Battery-Operated Vehicles. And if you watch it, you won't be alone. His TED Talk on this subject has received more than 1 million views on YouTube. I also want to ask Dr. Conway about his recent research on hydrogen-powered engines, so let's get started. Dr. Conway, welcome to Path to Zero.
Hey, thanks for having me here, Tucker. Great to be here.
We're going to look forward to this conversation because your background is just so fascinating. I know you have a mechanical engineering degree from Leeds University in the UK, and you also studied a lot about racing engine technology at Oxford. How did your interest in motorsports evolve into what you do now at Southwest Research?
Yeah, it's a pretty interesting backstory, and I'll try not to take up an entire hour giving it to you. I'll give you the short version. I've always been interested in engines, always been interested in helping my dad fix cars and trying to learn what they're all about. The work in racing engines, just to me, it's the pinnacle. It's the absolute, you know, where all the interesting innovation, all the interesting research really comes out from and dies down into the rest of the automotive industry. So it was really interesting to have that course at Oxford to look at some of the technology, look at some of the principles behind how you design a racing engine. And that led into me doing my PhD again in engines at the University of Leeds. From there, I went to work to Jaguar Land Rover in the UK, working again on advanced engine combustion topics. One of those topics was with Southwest Research Institute. So that's where that tie-in happened and eventually made it over to Texas to do the job I'm doing now, which is very, very broadly associated with the automotive industry in many areas.
Wonderful, wonderful journey. And we're glad you're here because you're doing great research. I want to encourage everyone to check out your TED Talk. It's about battery electric vehicles. It's really easy to find on YouTube. And then we'll also set a link up in the show notes of this episode. But Graham, straight at the very end, you said something I thought was interesting. And I want you to tell us what you meant. You said the future is not just electric. The future is eclectic. Tell us about what that means.
Yeah, so I think if you go into the industry, you talk to the general public, you talk to people, the perception is that a battery electric vehicle is zero emissions and that's the answer. Decarbonization means making everything electric. I think those in the technical side, on the engineering side, understand the challenges behind doing that and that we need to keep our options open. There are many, many pathways to decarbonization, not just a full electric route. And so I like to say, let's keep it eclectic. Let's keep our minds open. Let's look at all the possibilities. And I'd have to thank Dr. Kelly Senecal for stealing that slogan from him and using it in my TED Talk.
He's been a guest, and he is a great advocate of some of this you're talking about as well. So talk to me a little bit there, Dr. Conway, about how we let the narrative get that battery electric vehicles are zero emissions. Where did that narrative even begin? Because as a scientist, I know you realize that's not true, but I think the conventional person on the street has fed that narrative enough to actually believe it now.
Yeah, and it's by the way we currently define emissions in the US and in many other places in the world, we just look at what comes out of the tailpipe. That's where we take our measurement, and that's what we measure ourselves against and compare one technology to another. Once you take the tailpipe away, it very quickly becomes a zero measurement. And so that's the origin of why the battery electric vehicle and even the fuel cell get the moniker of zero emissions, because there is no tailpipe.
So let's talk about that a little bit. You've mentioned it a couple of times. Are we measuring the wrong things and then using those wrong measurements and making policy? And maybe just to follow on, let you talk about it a moment, what should we measure and what are the right measurements?
Yeah, so it comes down to a few different things. Generally, the major emissions from an internal combustion engine are nitrogen, water, and CO2, if everything goes well in the combustion process. Nitrogen pretty much makes up 80% of the atmosphere anyway, so that's not a big concern. It's CO2 that's one of the bigger concerns, along with some of the undesirable, incomplete products of combustion, carbon monoxide, nitrous oxide emissions, et cetera, et cetera. So when we talk about the emissions from the tailpipe, we need to split it into two categories: greenhouse gas emissions and criteria pollutant emissions. Now, for criteria pollutant emissions, those are the ones that go towards being detrimental to local air quality. Those ones are very important to understand locally where they come out of the vehicle, because those go into the atmosphere and they affect the local environment. For the greenhouse gas emissions, it's much, much broader, because greenhouse gas emissions are a global problem attributed to climate change. And so just looking at what comes out of a single vehicle doesn't really give you much of an indication as to what's happening with the greenhouse gas emissions. Ideally, you'd put a big measurement system around the entire globe and measure the greenhouse gas emissions, measure it from different technologies. You'd measure the greenhouse gas emissions produced to make a vehicle, to produce the electricity to drive an electric vehicle, to refine the fuel that we use in traditional vehicles. And so really what we need to be doing is what we call life cycle analysis, looking at the emissions at each stage of the process, because that's really what's important when we talk about greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, is trying to determine and define all of the pathways of emissions. And by doing that, we can then optimize and reduce them.
Interesting. Yet, I think policymakers and certainly consumers, the general public, don't seem to have any appetite to talk about life cycle emissions or life cycle analysis. And I don't know how to take a very complex scientific process and turn it into something that voters, policymakers can understand. Yet, as you say, it's the crux of the argument. I think for me, what I keep trying to understand is, will the earth be better off because of this migration to battery electric vehicles? And as someone who's deeply involved in life cycle analysis knows, the answer is quite possibly not, right?
Right, exactly. It's a cumulative project. It's a cumulative problem. So it's a problem that evolves over time. And so if you fast forward 100 years in the future and say everything's electric, would things be better then than they are now? The answer is yes. By then, we would have a lot more renewable sources of energy. By then, the battery production should be more efficient, have lower emissions associated with it. Things would be better. But it's a pathway to get to 100%. And it's a pathway to get all those improvements happening over that time period. And so we need to make sure we're minimizing the increase in footprint by making these strides towards renewable energy and electrification, because it integrates over that time. So we need to make sure we've got the minimum CO2 emission footprint in that 100 years, not just being lower in 100 years' time. And that's where the alternative technologies can make a big step.
You know, you referenced him earlier. It's interesting that you did. You referenced Dr. Kelly Senekal, who is at University of Wisconsin in Madison. You didn't mention his partner and fellow Englishman to you, Felix Leach, also a PhD from England, but their logic is very much like yours, that battery electric is but a very small part. An internal combustion engine certainly has a role to play, particularly an efficient one that is continually evolving. Their position, though, on hybrids, I thought was very unique in that they really believe hybrid vehicles are the vehicles of the future. What do you think about hybrids and climate and their role in today's transportation vehicles?
Yeah, I think I would agree with their position on it. I've worked with them on several projects, and we've all got a very similar opinion based on where we are today, where we want to get to, and also the techno-economic and materials resources side of things. So very often you can do a very simple calculation and you can see the electric motor is more efficient than the internal combustion engine, and everything rolls off from that. But well, why wouldn't we just do that today? And that's where the hybrid comes in. The hybrids are a very nice intermediate step to full electrification. It's very nice because it offers a very big efficiency benefit to a traditional internal combustion engine vehicle, 20-30% maybe straight away. It also reduces our reliance on raw earth materials. So a 100 kilowatt hour battery in an electric vehicle, you could make 101 kilowatt hour hybrids, and each of those hybrids would be 5-15% more efficient than it would have been before. So you can greatly expand and use those resources much more effectively to allow everybody to get into decarbonization. It's not possible for a lot of people just to buy an electric vehicle today. They're very expensive. Maybe if you can afford one, it's got a much lower range or a smaller cargo space than you're used to. And so your choice, your only choice to maintain your way of life is an internal combustion engine vehicle. The on-cost of a hybrid is not so much. And so you can get into decarbonization. You can do your part to lower emissions without having to make the big jump to the electric vehicle.
And let me ask you, because 10 years ago, hybrids were really complex, perhaps expensive. The control structure was a little bit questionable. Really today, I mean, I see where Toyota has gone and I see, but today those systems are much better, right? Cheaper, easier to control, fit into the way we own and operate vehicles, right?
Yeah, that's definitely true. 20 years ago, when we saw the Prius, people look at it the same way they looked at a Tesla 5 years ago. It was a new, scary technology. It wasn't what people were used to. And so it was, not considered something that we all want to go to as soon as possible. Today, pretty much all the major OEMs have some sort of hybrid in their fleet somewhere. The acceptance of it has risen. The OEMs need to look at these type of strategies to lower their overall CO2 footprint. And so it's just become attractive for many, many reasons. If you look at where fleets are today in the US and how far away they are from targets, CO2 targets set by the EPA, some of them are pretty far away from where they need to be. And if we look at the new proposals for the light duty market for model year 2026, a lot of the OEMs are really going to struggle to get down to those levels. But most of the companies who produce hybrid vehicles, their hybrid vehicles are already at the model year 26 standard. So to get a big increase in efficiency over the fleet and reduce emissions, moving to hybrids would be a great intermediate step for everyone involved. And it's just something I think we really need to be talking more about. We need more people to understand that they drive a hybrid and they're not even going to know they're driving a hybrid, other than it's probably going to be a little bit more quiet, when they're doing 5, 10, 15 miles an hour. Otherwise, they won't notice it. They'll still go and fill it up with their regular fuel. They won't have to plug it in unless they buy a plug-in hybrid. It'll just run like they're used to. They'll get better fuel economy, and they'll have a lower carbon footprint for the planet.
Yeah, excellent. Thank you so much for that. And when you talk about vehicles, I know the work at Southwest Research, I've been there many times. I see everything from motorcycles to Class 8 trucks. One of the things I find interesting is we seem to lump vehicles into one category, but it is a vast difference between light-duty passenger vehicles that go to and from the store and church versus 80,000-pound vehicles that are trying to go 600 or 700 miles. Do you see a stratification in hybrids and fuel choices as you think about those vehicles of different sizes and payloads?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's going to be eclectic. There's going to be different solutions for different sizes of the market. Generally, when you look at how things are evolving, the way things will move is there will be electrification. So either full electric or heavy hybridization of most of the light duty fleet. So the cars that you and I drive to work, that's going to be either fully electric or heavily hybridized. Once you get into the class 2A pickup trucks, you know, a Ford F-150, making that a full electric, that's an open-ended question. Yes, Ford have come out with the F-150 Lightning, the electric version, the electric vehicle version. But that's not going to work for everybody. If you live in a cold climate, or if you try and tow 12,000 pounds, that might not work for you. So there we'll see more engines. As you get into the larger and larger class 3, class 4, and up to class 8, the answer very much depends on the application of that vehicle. If it's a bus and it drives a prescribed route and a prescribed mileage, that might be perfect for electrification. You can have hub charging. You know, the bus does its route, comes back, you charge it. If it's class 8, where it's driving across the country, that's not the best solution. You're going to have to make sure there's megawatt charging infrastructure all along major routes in the US. The size and payload you can carry might be a little bit less depending on the weight of the vehicle and the battery pack. The recharge time is much slower, so freight efficiency might suffer. So there, we're looking at low carbon fuels, maybe fuel cells, or even hydrogen internal combustion engines. And as you get even larger into the locomotive, shipping, aviation space, there, we're just going to have to rely on liquid fuels for the foreseeable future. It's just very, very difficult to see alternatives in that space.
Really interesting to me that you see it so clearly. I tend to agree with your vision, yet that vision is so out of sync with a lot of the common narrative. Interesting to me also that you really don't demonize electric vehicles, but you in all your writings, and we've studied you quite a bit as we prepared for this, you just have a consistent call for fresh investment in the internal combustion engine because it even hasn't met its potential yet. What are the future potentials for internal combustion engines?
So the internal combustion engine has been around for a very, very long time. And there's been incremental improvements on it. Every year, every decade, there's a big difference. More recently, we've seen those differences increasing, which is really, really rare to see. You know, usually you would expect the biggest chunks of efficiency and benefits to be made early on, but very late in the life of the internal combustion engine, we're seeing big improvements. We're seeing new technologies enabled by advanced computer fluid dynamics techniques. We're seeing advances in automation, machine learning, really pushing the engine forward. When we look at emissions from engines over the last 20 years, it's been slashed. It's just come down so much. And there's still a lot of potential there. When we see the internal combustion engine, a good gasoline engine is 40% efficient. A good diesel engine is 50%, maybe a little bit higher. And that still leaves room for potential. So my point is that I want to make, and we're certainly seeing it here at Southwest Research, is investment in pure research and development topics for combustion engines has reduced, especially on the gasoline side. My conjecture is that we're going to have internal combustion engines for a very, very, very long time. And it just seems unsatisfactory that in 20 years' time, you'll go and buy an internal combustion engine vehicle and it will have technology from 20 years ago on it, because nobody's invested and nobody's improved it in that time frame. And as I mentioned earlier, the pathway to reducing climate change and reducing temperatures and reducing greenhouse gas emissions, it's an integrated approach. It's going to take place over a long time. And so we need to be making changes today to make sure we get to where we want to be in the future at the right pace and at the right, on the right trajectory.
Which again plays right into what we said. There isn't this narrow path towards a cleaner climate. It's a path with as many possibilities as possible. So you and I are welcome to drive a battery electric vehicle to and from the store, and we'll need to drive our trucks as we deliver the bread, deliver the mail, that kind of thing. It's perfectly logical to me. Dr. Conway, we're going to take a break and be back in just a moment.
Zero is a big number. Getting close to a zero emissions future starts with using the broadest mix of clean, low carbon energy sources. You might be surprised to know that propane produces a lot of energy for thousands of purposes and millions of people, with virtually zero particulate matter, zero impact to the ozone, zero toxicity, and zero potential for storage-related contamination. It's low NOx and low CO2 to boot. Path to Zero is sponsored by Propane. Energy for everyone. Learn more at propane.com.
Welcome back. Our guest is Dr. Graham Conway, Principal Engineer in the Automotive Division for Southwest Research Institute. You've kind of wandered into fuel cells, and I know that walks us into hydrogen a little bit. I'm well aware that you and your colleagues at Southwest Research have been looking at hydrogen and internal combustion engines. So talk to us a little bit about those experiments, and perhaps more importantly, where those experiments are leading you to where you believe we'll go with a hydrogen future.
As I guess if we go back 20 minutes and we talk about why it's zero emissions and why that name exists, it's because of the lack of a tailpipe. And that's because if you don't have a tailpipe, you can't measure carbon dioxide emissions. Now, the same is true with a hydrogen engine. Because there's no carbon associated with the fuel, when you burn hydrogen in an engine, you don't produce any CO2. Maybe there's trace amounts from a lubricant, combustion of a lubricant, but it's very, very close to zero. And so that's a really exciting position for us to be in, is to look at how we can move towards that as a potential option for this eclectic future. Now, of course, the hydrogen has to be created. There's different ways of creating hydrogen. There's all the colors of the rainbow and more. There's a spectrum given to the colors of hydrogen. Currently, it's not so clean, but we're making improvements in that space. But even then, there's still options for the hydrogen internal combustion engine. And so we're looking at what's the best way to burn hydrogen in an internal combustion engine. It's different to gasoline, it's very different to diesel, it's different to propane, it's different to all the other fuels out there. It's a very extreme fuel, burns very, very quickly, ignites very, very easily, isn't the nicest fuel to work with from a safety point of view, but has a lot of potential because of things like burning quickly. So we're trying to extend that and figure out how much can we get out of that that fuel.
You know, I want to ask you, because you're one of the few people that talk about hydrogen and address it concerns around safety. I certainly believe that we may be able to get there as we think about an engine that burns hydrogen efficiently. And I'll leave it to others to think about what color hydrogen they want to use and the carbon intensity thereof. But do you believe that we can solve the problems that are inherent with hydrogen in one element, number one, I believe, on the periodic table, it doesn't want to stay anywhere very long. It loves to escape its home and go away. And as you said, it's also very explosive and combustible. Do you think we can overcome that into a fuel into the mainstream?
So some of the challenges with hydrogen, you're never going to be able to fix because it's just the nature of, as you said, it being number one on the periodic table. So things like energy density, in terms of volumetric energy density, that's always going to be very, very difficult to improve upon. The biggest challenges with hydrogen at the moment for the US market are, well, where do we get the hydrogen from? How can I get hydrogen into my car or my truck? How much am I going to pay for it? And these are all problems that need to be addressed. There was a survey in 2020 on EV driver acceptability or EV vehicle acceptability. And the question was, what is the biggest barrier to buying an EV today? And two thirds of the 100,000 respondents said the lack of electric vehicle charging infrastructure is the biggest barrier for me getting an electric vehicle today. And at the time, there were 43,000 EV public charging stations at level two and 120,000 individual level two charging plugs. So with 120,000 opportunities to recharge, people still said it's not enough. There are 52 hydrogen refueling stations in the US. So that just gives you an indication of where things would need to move. And I think I've been pretty open with it in saying, I think the opportunities for light duty hydrogen in the US is somewhere near zero, because you would just need an enormous investment in the hydrogen infrastructure to make that happen. For the Class A type vehicles, the heavier vehicles, where you could rely upon hub-based hydrogen refueling, there's an opportunity there. You could build specific strategically placed hubs on the East Coast, West Coast routes and make that happen. The cost is a big challenge. We can produce hydrogen extremely cheaply today. It's a waste product in many chemical processes. The problem is you need to compress it. You need to put it in a truck. You can't put much of it in a truck. Then you have to drive that truck, a diesel truck, 1,000 miles to get it to the station, put it in a tank, and then put the taxes on it, the profits on it. And by the time you do that in California, it's $13, $14 per kilogram. And that's something that can only be fixed by generating the hydrogen at the station. So you need electrolysis of water at the site, and you ideally need a solar field behind it to do it cleanly. You still have to compress, but that's the only way to see it being economically viable. But of course, someone's got to pay for that.
And one day, if we're not already there, water will be as important to us as the climate, I think. And we're beginning to see that now. And I don't think many people realize the amount of water it takes to really produce hydrogen. So yeah. Well said. Love the clarity in your response. Graham, this is the fun part of the show, where in just a moment, I'm going to hand you a magic wand. So we use magic on this show. With this magic wand, you can wave it and wish for one thing. That's a criteria, one thing that will have the biggest impact on climate change in the next year. Graham, how would you use your magic wand? What would you wish for?
I think I'd wish for education. So I wouldn't want to just wave a wand and insist on a specific technology or a specific strategy, because I think it would be unsustainable. I think what we need to do is educate people, let people understand the life cycle aspects of owning a vehicle. Let them understand if they only drive 20 miles a day and they never go more than 50 miles and they've got a reasonably good, or they're financially sound and they can afford it, buy the electric vehicle. Buy the electric vehicle, enjoy the electric vehicle and all the benefits that come along with it. But I want the other person to think, do I need to buy a 200 kilowatt hour Hummer electric vehicle? Or can I get something that's going to be a little bit more efficient, and release some of the resources rather than making huge battery packs. And that would be my wish, is for everybody to understand life cycle analysis and the implications of it, and then have the opportunity to use that knowledge when they pick their next choice of vehicle.
Excellent use of the magic wand. Thank you so much for that. So you work at a great place, Southwest Research Institute, strong enough to attract you all the way across the Atlantic. So I think you agree it's a great place. You want to tell our listeners about any of the other work that's going on there or things that you think would be of interest to them?
Yeah, so we're active in pretty much all of the areas of physical sciences. I could tell you all the interesting work we do with NASA in putting objects into space. But for the automotive audience, and for those interested in power generation and decarbonization, there's also lots of other things we're working on. One of the more interesting things is supercritical CO2. So once you pressurize CO2 to 80, 90 bar at room temperature, it becomes a supercritical fluid. So it's kind of got some of the properties of gas and liquid. It's an extremely dense vapor, we can say. And we're using that to make very efficient heat regeneration cycles, so Brayton cycle type operation, making strides towards improving efficiency in the power plant generation space as well. Lots of other work on hydrogen. We're looking at CO2 capture membranes, so to take CO2 out of the atmosphere and do useful things with it. So pretty much anywhere you look, somebody's doing something interesting in the area of decarbonization.
Thank you. It's such great work down there. Let me ask you one last question. I happened to be with Dr. Scott Tinker 2 weeks ago and had a chance to visit, and he shares a lot of the same views as you do about the complexity of making batteries, using batteries, disposing of batteries, and all of that rare earth. But he also had a less impressive view of renewable fuels than I think even I do. Do you, as we think about renewable diesel, renewable propane, sustainable aviation fuel, do you find that those are fuels of the future, or in fact, are they just energy sinks with not much environmental benefit?
So I think there's benefits for them. I think you have to use them strategically because they're limited. There's not enough to go around the entire fleet from light duty all the way up to shipping and aviation. There just isn't enough. And so I think you have to be quite clever with how you use them. And I don't think we want to go down the path of growing as many crops as we can or coming up with everything renewable. It's challenges with that too. I think we need to increase what we're currently doing, but then I think we need to use those fuels very carefully, probably for the larger vehicle segments that are the hardest to decarbonize with electrification.
Excellent. We want to thank you for being our guest, and we do that in a unique way. We'll want to plant a tree in your name in a national forest, and we call it the virtual national forest, but it's really the propane national forest. It's all about guests, and we really appreciate that. You get to pick the forest where we plant your tree. Now, I know you're living in San Antonio, and we got a couple favorites around there, Davy Crockett National Forest, and in East Texas, the Sabine National Forest. Do you have a favorite or somewhere else that we would love to plant a tree in your name?
Yeah, so, I mean, my backyard has a lot of oak trees, but I could always do with another tree, but perhaps we'll go somewhere else. So Davy Crockett is probably where I would pick, just because about 4 or 5 weeks ago, I was there for a bicycle race. I'd never heard of it before, obviously heard of Davy Crockett, but hadn't actually been to Crockett before, so went to Crockett for the Davy Crockett race, and so that rings a bell to me, so I think I'll pick that.
Well, that's a great pick, and we will enjoy adding a tree in your name into the propane national forest that already exists there at Davy Crockett, so that's great. I want to leave our listeners with one more time, I think, one of your great sayings out of your TED Talk, and let's see if I get it right. It's not, the future is not just electric, it's eclectic. I get that right?
That's right.
I want to drive them to your TED Talk. It's well worth the time it takes to listen to it. Graham, thanks so much for this conversation. I know I learned a lot, and I'm always fascinated how scientists who are studying this issue can be so straightforward, and those who are not scientists can sometimes not be quite as straightforward. So I thank you for that. Thanks again for being our guest.
Thanks, Tucker. Thanks for having me on, and it's been a really interesting conversation.
That wraps up this episode of Path to Zero. And a quick reminder, if you want to send me a note to comment on an episode or give me a new topic to consider, just shoot me an email. The address is path2zero, that's path, the word to, zero, at propane.com. You can also connect with me on LinkedIn, and I always look forward to hearing from you. With that, a big thank you to everyone listening. See you next time on Path to Zero.
Thank you for listening to Path to Zero with Tucker Perkins. If you like what you've heard, subscribe and rate us your favorite podcast app. You can email us with questions or comments to path2zero@propane.com.